Hi, it's Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. Here is the first part of our six-part teleseminar series with master business buyer and expert Arthur Hamill. We cover about 30 questions in this first segment. I hope you enjoy. Now let's get going. First question, Art, what is the single biggest reason that makes the current economic environment a great time to buy a business?
Well, one of the reasons I always like to buy during these times is the fact that owners are more motivated to sell. Again, the only problem we run into is a lot of times they'll say, oh, Scott, the economy's bad and I don't want to sell my business now. So we have done last year, and again, I don't want to make this too complicated, but we have what we call is a reverse earnout. An earnout in business is a term that applies to myself. Say I'm trying to buy a company from you. It's called an earnout. So we disagree on price because I want to buy it based on what it's doing this year. You're telling me about all the business it's going to do in the next couple of years. So all I do is I buy the company, the price based on what you did last year, 2008. And what we do is we set up an earnout. In other words, you get a percent of the increased profits over the next 3, 4, or 5 years, okay, which gives us a middle ground. Now, what we've been doing, and I started doing this with a modular housing company in Pennsylvania, we did the same thing, and I said to the owner, I said, I know your business is off. You did $3-4 million the last couple of years. The last year you did only about $1 million, or a little over $1 million. I'm going to pay you the price based on 2008 buying this company, and now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an earnout on the reverse. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you additional profit based on additional profit over the next few years, and to earn back as much as you can of the sales and profit you've had in the last couple of years. So in other words, I'm going to let you earn out or get more back based on what you had made in the last couple of years.
Is that something new, or has it been around a while? It sounds perfect, because if the guy claims and believes his business is going to do that much greater, why would he say no if he wasn't serious?
I have only experienced this with one. I've never heard of this before. I've told other people about it, and they looked at me sort of strange. Like, over all the years I've done this, I've always come up with approaches or formulas, whatever you want to call them, in buying companies based on the problem at that time. And so since we've had this problem a lot this last year or so, I was sitting there thinking, hey, why don't we do this? It doesn't make any difference whether I'm doing it in the next years or based on the last year. Okay? What we're doing is we're solving a problem. Or a couple of problems. And it works very well.
Okay. Art, with credit so tight and the equity market in shambles now, is it a good time to try and buy a company?
Well, when you're talking about equity companies, the equity companies are usually going after the multi-million dollar companies. Most of the time, we do not get involved with private equity companies. Also, private equity companies, a lot of people go to a private equity company and think you can go to them and borrow money to buy a business or something like that, and you really can't. The private equity companies are in the business of buying companies for themselves. So if you go to them, you try to work an arrangement where they give you part ownership, it's not going to happen because that's against what their purpose really is. Now, the other thing is, as far as the finance market or being able to get loans, you can start with the Small Business Administration as an example. There's been all sorts of crap out there for the last couple of years about the SBA not doing certain things. Anything the SBA has done basically has made it tougher to get these loans. They have it set up now that you have to have knowledge of that type of business, or they won't provide the SBA guarantee. They want the seller of the business to keep 10, 20, 30% of the company, which is, again, something new. And right now, there's a lot of people out there in the SBA market that have a feeling that Obama is trying to kill the SBA business, SBA guarantee business. So who knows? But keep in mind, when Ronald Reagan was our president, he spent a lot of his 8 years trying to kill the Small Business Administration because he considered it a waste of time.
Has the economic environment altered any of your business buying strategies other than the loan out?
No, not really. You know, I hear about this all the time, but I'm one of those persons that lets it bounce off my head. In other words, I go out there, there may be opportunities out there. Most of the businesses I go after are businesses that don't have peaks and valleys or don't have large peaks and valleys. So we don't really run to that. I go to banks, and a lot of times we're getting lines of credit from a bank, and people tell me you can't get those. And I said, well, I just got one. What I try to do is not listen to what the public is saying or what I'm reading because it's always discouraging every so many years. So I don't think about it. I don't honor it. I just go around it.
What, if anything, should I pay particular attention under current economic and market conditions that would be much less important under normal conditions?
Well, you know, whether it's normal conditions or the conditions you have today, what you have to do is you have to go after businesses that are not in the area that have peaks and valleys, like real estate businesses have lots of peaks and valleys. The finance businesses have peaks and valleys. And what you have to do is stay away from those areas because they're going to kill you. The other thing is you have to always keep in mind one thing. You want to buy a business that has had 3 years, at least 3 years of continuous increased profit and sales. Okay, 3 years up. Now, if you've had one big year where it's been down, you can't buy that company because what's going to happen is, especially if you bring an investor in, normally your business will fall off so much that you will not be able to pay your investor, much less feed your family. So you can't go after those. You have to say, I'm not going to buy those. They're great opportunities right now because business is off. So what you do is, again, you go after 3 years of straight up profit and loss. And the other thing is, you're also looking for businesses that don't require a rocket scientist. And what I'm saying about that is, if you're leaving somebody else in there as a manager, what you have to do is you don't want a manager that you can't replace easily because of the, not the licensing so much, but the technique. Maybe you have to have a manufacturing engineer or a rocket scientist to run your company. That person is going to be very valuable. The problem is, if you have problems with him, you're going to find yourself in a position where you don't really have control over your company.
All right, so the people listening to the news and, I guess, experiencing the so-called depression believe that every single business in the world is down. That's simply not true. There are still businesses that are thriving in this economic climate.
All I can tell you is I live in a different world than a lot of people do because I'm always going out after the better businesses. So all I can tell you is this year, last year, and every year, in the last 53 years I've been doing this, most of the businesses have been doing well. Again, this is just based on my casual observation. I say, okay, I've run into 4 businesses this year that are really down out of maybe 20. And I don't know what the number is because I don't really think about it. But the thing is, if you go out there and look at the businesses just at random, you're going to find that there's very few of them that are really in trouble. The government's in trouble. The government in the United States especially has screwed everything up. What happened is they let the economy get out of control. Then every so many years, they usually pull a pin on real estate. Real estate normally is not as bad as it is this time. But in the past, if you go back every so many years, it's real estate that was taking off. And the government then came up with some technique to screw it up, to dump the country back.
Being in business over 50 years, what do you think is going to happen over the next several years with the economy and the market and all that? Just your gut feeling.
My gut feeling is, even if Obama continues to screw up our economy, it's going to come back. I mean, it just does. I mean, even if they did nothing, it would come back. It may take longer. For someone of those persons that believes if you have an economy problem, you should correct it by tax ramifications, because in the past, in the U.S. especially, every time they've done something to bring the taxes down for people, say, on capital gains or things like that, it brings the economy back because the people then will go out and sell their stock or whatever it happens to be. When they sell their stock, they're taxable. They do a lot of taxable things. They sell their businesses. And what happens is that money comes in, and they have more money coming in than they ever had before.
If you're following Obama and the new administration, have you learned of any potential changes that would affect buying a business over the next couple of years, that he's doing?
Let's look at it this way. If you're one of those persons that thinks that Congress is going to protect you on a stimulus bill of X number of billion dollars, the people that were in Congress didn't even get to read it. They just signed off on it without even reading the damn thing, which I've never heard of before. So who knows? Again, I haven't seen the stimulus bill. I just hear different things about it. And the pieces I have seen, which his opponents probably bring up, just seem to be a transfer of wealth, not something that's going to help our country turn around.
Okay. All right, this next section of questions is all based on how do I get started. And the first one is, Art, what is the best and fastest way to buy and own a winning business? And I know it's a general question, but you can just, maybe it's the first thing that comes off in your mind.
Well, first thing I always tell people is the world is going to tell you, I don't care where you're on the world, the easiest thing to do is go out and start a business because you don't have a lot of money, because you don't have a lot of skill. And what's going to happen is that's absolutely backwards from what you should be doing, because when you go out to buy a business, you're going to find that if you find a business that's making money, there are a number of ways that you can finance this, which means you get into a business and you take over on Monday, and that Friday, when payroll comes up, you can actually make the payroll. When you start a business, you hire so many people. The problem you have every Friday, if you're paying every Friday, which most people around the world do, what's going to happen is you're not going to have the money to make payroll. You're going to have these problems. You're going to have headaches. I've started a lot of businesses. I've purchased more existing businesses than I have started. All I can tell you is my life changed tremendously when I quit starting these things. I mean, because it's a terrible thing. But the world is always telling you, you can do it, get in there cheaper. You don't have to have experience. Well, think about it. Let's say you go into a business, you don't have any experience. Suppose you buy an existing business, and the manager stays, which they do most of the time. Well, if they stay, doesn't that person have a lot of experience? Yes, they do. You may not have any experience. You may not be able to read and write. It doesn't make any difference. Why? Let the person run the company. And I always tell people, when you buy an existing company, if you go in there and start making changes or telling the existing manager what to do, he's going to get very upset with you. Because that's the thing every manager of a company worries about when a buyer comes in. So I always tell people, we're going to close escrow at 10 o'clock in the morning. I want you to meet me for lunch, you and your wife. Before you get there, I want you to purchase 2 first-class tickets to Tahiti. And when you meet me for lunch, we're going to talk. And what I'm going to tell you is, look, we're going to go to Tahiti. Now, I've set it up down there. You're going to pay for this. But I set it at the fanciest resort you can get into. So you and your wife are going to fly down first class. You're going to stay in this great resort. And the thing that's key is there are no telephones in that whole area, not for hundreds of miles. And the buyer always said, well, my God, the business is going to fail. I said, no, it isn't. I said, the only thing that screws up new businesses is when a new owner comes in and starts to make changes. I said, the person that's been running it has been running it for 5 or 10 years successfully. And if you go in there and start screwing around with it, you're going to goof up the business, and you're also going to get everybody irritated with you. So stay in Tahiti.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Good answer, and this comes into this next question. What kind of experience do you need to buy a company?
Okay, again, as I was just saying on the Small Business Administration, this is the first time I've ever heard of them coming to the point where the person has to have experience in that business. Now, in addition to the SBA, I have heard of a couple of banks that are doing the same thing right now and saying you have to have experience to go into that business. And is that smart? Of course it is, because one of the reasons that people fail is they don't know anything about business, period. They don't know anything about the business they're buying. So over all the years that I've been out there teaching, say, the last 40 years, I've always taught one thing, and that is you work as an absentee owner. Now, this doesn't mean you're going to be out playing golf every day. You're not going to oversee your business. But what you're going to do is you're going to have a business where you leave the management in place, or if the manager's leaving, over the next couple of months, you're going to replace that manager with another manager that has experience in that business. And if you do that, even if you're an idiot, you will not fail. And again, I've got a lot of people I work with buying businesses that really don't have the ability at this time to run that company. They will later. They don't have that ability. So what I always do to protect myself and protect investors, I make sure that they do not take over and start running that company. And that's the main reason I do that.
Okay. How do you go about acquiring a profitable franchise?
Well, that's probably the easiest thing to do. Go on the Internet, and I don't care where you are in the world. Just go on, let's take Biz Buy Sell. They have an area just for franchises, existing ones and also new ones. Don't be intimidated when you go on some of these sites. Or you can go on a site for McDonald's. I mean, if you want to own a McDonald's franchise, or if you know the name of the franchise, go on the Internet. And you're going to find all sorts of opportunities on there. First of all, they're going to try to sell you an existing one. Secondly, they're going to try to sell you one that somebody failed in and they had to take back. Thirdly, you'll find one that's for sale that's making money and the person is just tired of running that franchise. So it runs 1, 2, 3 in reverse order. But don't be discouraged. There's enough of them out there in every category because there's, I was going to say, tens of thousands of franchises in just the U.S. There's hundreds of thousands of them in the United States, and they're also all over the world, wherever you happen to be. You know, as I talk about these things, I don't care where you are in the world. Everything I'm talking about now applies in every country. I mean, even if we talked about the United States and the financing problems here, the same thing I find is true all over the world. But don't get discouraged.
How about participating in such a business from outside the U.S.? So let's say you live in the U.S. and you're looking at businesses in other countries. What should I be looking for? Is that something that can be done?
Yes. Nothing changes. 35 years ago, I hate to keep using these old days, but 35 years ago, I had an opportunity. First of all, I got involved in two manufacturing companies in Tecate, Mexico. And from that, they came to me and asked me if I'd like to buy a company in Guadalajara. It was actually in the ceramics business. I don't even know how to spell ceramics, okay? But it was an existing business, and we worked the thing backwards. In other words, they didn't have enough business going. They were losing money. So what I did is I went to the U.S. market, and actually I went to the International Manufacturing Show that they have in Chicago every January, where manufacturing people come in from all over the world. And I just walked through the thing, and when the people weren't busy, I would talk to them, ask them where they were having their ceramics manufactured. And they'd say, well, we're manufacturing in Germany, we're manufacturing in Portugal, which was the biggest one we got, which was the red clay cooking pots, Romertoff. I don't know if anybody's heard of that. But they're out of Germany. They're very big all over the world. And it took me 2 years to put this together, but I actually got the people in New York that control the sales franchise for North and South America and the owners of the company in Germany to transfer part of the product to Mexico. When we did that, the problem we had was, first of all, the Germans at that time did not believe the people in Mexico could build anything. Okay, this was 35 years ago. I convinced them. They met them. These people, the two of them who were running this plant, were graduates of MIT in engineering. Also, one of the brothers had a master's degree in ceramics. I mean, they had a perfect operation. In fact, after about a year or two of us manufacturing for them just on a limited basis, they turned the production over to this company in Mexico for the whole world. It turned out very well. Don't be afraid of it. What happens is if you go into another country, there may be a language problem. But just keep in mind, I owned a number of companies in Mexico, and I did not have problems. I mean, I had high school Spanish for a year or two. I don't remember doing very well. I was down there in business for 15 years, and I got by. I was able to feed myself. And the only problem I had, we owned a number of companies, and they delighted in playing games with me. So I'd always go in the morning and say good morning in Spanish, and they'd return it in English. I'd say, how am I going to practice if you guys don't let me? They said, we don't want you practicing. We want you to bring more business into the plant. So I said, okay.
That's funny. Is that business still going, or it is?
Every business that we had in Mexico was still going.
And did you sell out of it, or do you still have part ownership in it?
I sold out of the ones I had. I was down there in business for 15 years. If anybody wants to check on me, they'll find out. If they were on your website, as a matter of fact, they'd find out how many companies I've owned down there. But since they'll probably do that because of this, over a 15-year period, we ended up owning 17 companies, and none of them failed. Keep in mind, what I did is I took all the production we had where they were selling to Central and South America, and I converted that to the U.S. market. In other words, I went to the U.S. and got jobs, or I had our salespeople do that. And over the years, what we did is we converted everything over to the U.S. So we were paying our bills in pesos in Mexico. We were being paid for our production from the U.S. in dollars. And every time the peso would be devalued, we'd make even more money. In fact, I was down in Mexico in business. We had a number of them at that time. When they devalued the peso, I mean, they cut the value in half, which means all of our expenses were cut in half. Right now, I think the dollar is having the same problem.
Right, right. Okay. Here's a question, and you probably hear it a lot. How do you establish credibility, especially when new in the United States?
You're new in the United States, whatever. First of all, you have to believe in yourself. And I always tell people two things. And when I do this, they always look at me very strange. They say, what are you talking about? I said, first of all, are you married? They said, yes. I want you to go into the mirror in your house, okay? What I want you to do is talk to that mirror and say, I have extensive experience in the electronics business. I have extensive experience in the electronics business. And again, it's not that we're trying to misrepresent with the sellers. It's just that we don't want you to get in a situation when you're in there negotiating to buy that business and the broker or the merger and acquisition person or the seller, basically the question said, how long have you been in the business? And you're going to go, and stammer and stutter. You have to get to the point where you believe in yourself. And although this mirror thing seems ridiculous, it does work. And what happens is, if you keep looking at the mirror, practicing, and then turn to your spouse and say, hi, I have a lot of experience in manufacturing electronics, whatever it is, if your wife doesn't believe you, you continue on. Now, if you don't believe this, you don't want to do it this way, fine. You'll go out and you'll screw up the first 5 or 10 business deals, because you didn't do this, because you'll end up stammering and stuttering, and then finally, after doing it 5, 6 times, 7 times, it'll finally dawn on you, hey, I have to get more knowledge on this thing, and then come back in and be knowledgeable and have the appearance. And the second thing has to do with money. Now, what happens is, I don't care where you are in the world, every agent representing the seller is always worried about the fact that you don't have enough money to buy the company. You don't have a wherewithal. Again, go to the mirror and convince yourself, because what's going to happen is they're going to bring it up and they're going to turn to you and say, do you have X number of dollars to buy this company? Now, you can say, well, God, I only have a dollar down. I'm going to finance the rest. That will kill it with most people, because most people are looking for somebody coming in that has all the money to buy all the company for all cash. Even if you have a lot of techniques for going out and financing, if you don't convince them in the meetings that you can bring all the cash to the table, they're not going to let you buy the company. They're going to quit doing business with you. So you have to convince yourself. Again, are you lying? No. What you have to do, it's one of those things where I don't want you to panic in a meeting. I want you to sit there when they ask you the question, say, yes, I have the money to buy the company.
Do you think they're going to push in to make you show financials, and what if they want proof?
Okay. First of all, on the financial part of it, most of that comes up before you get there. Now, there's two ways you can buy a company. The easiest way is to go on the Internet, and you can do that in any country, as you know. Go on the Internet, and the problem is today you're going to have brokers that are going to be on there. Very seldom will you find a seller of a company. So what you're going to do is work with brokers. Now, the brokers have gotten listings all over the world the same way. How do they get them? They get them by promising the seller they're going to get them all cash. Because they're always going to say, well, why should I list with you? I can sell it myself. They'll say, I know, but a lot of people are going to come in without any money. I qualify them. So since they've qualified them, as soon as a buyer tries to come into these brokers after the fact, they always give them a hard time. How do I know this? I get thousands of phone calls every year from people I'm working with. I mean, thousands of them. And of the calls I get with problems in business, that represents 99.999% of problems people have when they buy a business. The average broker, well, I might as well tell you the truth, is an incompetent person. And also, they do too good of a job at trying to kill the deal. The other thing is they're also promising them that they're going to bring a person to the table that has a lot of experience. They're going to promise them a lot of different things to get this listing. So what you have to do is realize if you go that way, you better prepare yourself for this. Or what they're going to do is, again, when you first get there, again, this goes in steps. Some of the brokers will let you through. They're usually the new ones or the ones that haven't been selling many businesses. And the average business broker does not sell many businesses every year, as you'll find out. And again, as you work with them, you'll understand why they don't sell that many. So what happens is the ones that aren't doing well may let you through the gauntlet. Okay. Now, second one is going to say to you, okay, I sent you a package. Say you do it on the Internet. He's going to say, I'm going to send you back a package of information on this business. Now, I want you to sign a non-disclosure document, and then I'll send it. Okay. Then the second group will actually send you the package, but then they'll tell you you can't go any further without the financial statement. In other words, as you go along, they're going to keep holding you back unless you get a financial statement. In the old days, it used to be they wanted bank guarantees. And then as banks got in trouble, I don't mean this time, I mean years ago, they got away from that, bringing that up. So what you have to do is if you go that way, you have to prepare yourself for what you're going to run into, and you're going to have to be strong to get by them. Okay? Again, the mirror trick works. You don't want to do that. Do it the way that's the easiest, which is you send documents. Again, I don't care where you're in the world. There are books in your library that basically have information on all these different companies in your country, or you go to Dun & Bradstreet or another type reporting service, whatever you have in your country. What will happen, they'll give you a printout of all businesses making $50,000 a year, all businesses making $100,000 a year, whatever it happens to be, and they give this to you. Now, what we do then is we then suggest that you write to or contact in some manner the people on this list. Again, we're normally writing. It's just calling in is very difficult because of what we call the gatekeeper, and that is the person that's answering the phone. It's been told by the seller that he doesn't want to get calls or she doesn't want to get calls on just anything. So if you try that, and again, this is based on my 53 years, you're going to find you don't have to call a person like me and complain about the fact that the brokers were nasty to you. And what's going to happen is you're going to find you went directly to the sellers, you work with them. Do they ever ask you for financials? Very seldom. Should they? Yes. Now, if I were recommending, if I were training these sellers, again, not the brokers, but the sellers, I would be training them to qualify you coming in so they don't waste your time. But since we're usually coming in from the buyer's side, and since they don't check, you get in there a lot easier. And take advantage of it. Now, for those of you that don't believe this writing or contacting sellers works, how do you think the brokers and merger and acquisition people across the planet get your listings? How do you think the private equity companies find out about businesses? Well, they call people like me, but these companies, all of them, and people like you, if you want to listen to me, all do the same thing. You write the letters, contact them. Now, the private equity companies and the brokers will send them postcards, send them emails, call them on the phone at home, whatever it takes. The people I work with that are coming in like yourself as a buyer, we don't do that. We just send letters to them.
Yeah, you do what the brokers do. The brokers have to get the listings, and they call them, and they contact them, and there's no reason you can't do the exact same thing.
Well, just keep in mind, for those of you around the world, if you go back to me, to when I started teaching 40-some years ago, very few business brokers are merger and acquisition people on this planet. They didn't exist. Where did most of them come from? I hate to tell you, my seminar. Because I had people in every seminar that I taught in every part of the country that said they wanted to be the first in St. Louis. They wanted to be the first in New York. When I heard this, I thought, huh? I didn't believe it. So when I'm telling you how they get the listings, the reason they did it this way is that's what I trained the people to do, whether they were buyers or brokers or bankers. It was the easiest way to do it.
Now, when you first started, were there business brokers, or didn't you start one of the very first kind of organizations?
Okay, years ago, I had 5 business brokerage offices. I had one in Seattle, one in Portland, one in San Jose, California.
Were there other broker offices around at that time?
Not very many. Okay, but you see, this was after I started teaching. But when I first started 40-some years ago, I didn't know where they were. I did not know about this.
You didn't know that there were people who broker business transactions?
Well, I'll tell you how dumb I was. Before I got into Mexico and stuff, 50 years ago, I was in the restaurant business. Talk about being stupid. After I had been in that business a couple of years, I ran into a friend of mine who was in real estate, and I said, how do I sell these businesses? And he says, you have to find a broker. I said, oh. I said, you mean a business broker? He says, no, there are no business brokers around. You get a real estate license, and then you'll learn the real estate brokers that sell businesses. Well, I ended up teaching these people later, this program, and also the first professional designation for business brokers and merger and acquisition people is a thing called certified business counselors. And from this have come out all sorts of organizations across the United States and across the world that all were based on the company that I put together. Why did I do it? Not because I was trying to help the brokerage field. I was trying to get them to clean up their act. I was trying to get them to be ethical. I was trying to get them to share listings with each other so that it would be easier to sell the businesses.
Well, these business brokers remind me of all the mortgage brokers. The mortgage brokers would sell anyone one of these funky loans because they just want their commission. Isn't it kind of like the same thing?
With business brokers, it's even worse. And the reason it is, selling a business is a lot more difficult than getting somebody to sign up for a mortgage or to buy real estate. It's more difficult. It's more difficult to make a living. The reason I'm probably making excuses for them right now, but it's the only thing I've been able to figure out, that because of the difficulty and them trying to survive, they end up doing this. Because I've seen a lot of them when they started, and then I see them a couple of years later, and I can see the change in them. Incidentally, even on the Internet, I don't know if most of you realize, but on the Internet in the beginning, they had a lot of websites on there for businesses for sale, but they were all buyers. Then what happened is the brokerage offices, and again, the brokerage office I had, every time we had a meeting, we would say, okay, go to the Internet and try to get 5 listings in the next week. What they do is they go on the Internet, they find out which buyers had which businesses, and then they badger the hell out of them until they got a listing. Probably worse than badgering.
All right. Here's a question. Is cash flow the number one reason one should consider when buying a business?
Yes.
All right, just explain, what is cash flow?
Okay, it's a lot of different things. Some people call it EBITDA, EBIT. There's all sorts of designations. Again, I try to keep it as simple as possible. When I'm working with a buyer, I'm working with a seller. Even the sellers don't understand all the different ramifications of cash flow. But we're usually talking about how much money does the seller have after he pays all his expenses. In other words, how much money did he put in your pocket? Just keep it as simple as that. And when you get in there and somebody's talking about EBITDA and all this other, you're going to have to ask them what they mean by that. Again, brokers and stuff are using a technique like that so they can communicate. When you're out in the real world working with sellers and buyers, if you use those terms, they wouldn't know what you're talking about.
So cash flow, it's what the business is making every month, in essence.
Usually every year.
Every year.
Yeah.
You know, if there's no cash flow, there's no reason to buy the business.
or if there's not enough cash flow. Because here's the thing. I used to tell people years ago when they were selling these small businesses that what you had to do in order to put a deal together is work it backwards. In other words, you had to set the thing up. Say the seller carried back financing. Okay, let's say it was a $100,000 deal. Let's say the owner was carrying back $50,000 in financing. I don't mean the amount. I mean the amount of the payments on the financing, $50,000 a year. That left $50,000 for the business. Now, you had to find out from the buyer how much money he and his family needed to live on if he was going to run the company. I don't mean something where you bring a manager in. You can't on something that's small. But on those, what we were doing is staying in. In other words, could you live on $50,000 a year? Because if you put a deal together where you have $50,000 in financing and the company's doing $70,000, it's not going to work. Even if you convince the buyer to do that, the problem is they're not going to be able to survive on the money they have left. So we basically, it's simple, just work it backwards on the smaller ones. Once you get up usually over $250,000 net, we're not doing it that way. Okay, because what we're doing is looking at pure cash flow on something like that. In other words, I want to know if this company is making $250,000 after everything, including paying manager. Okay, you can put back in all the expenses for the seller. That's fine. But then we have to subtract out what it's going to cost for a manager. Because I want to know is how much money do I put in my pocket? How much cash flow do I have?
Okay. We're in the next section of questions, and the subject is, how can I buy a business with little or no money, no experience, bad credit, unemployment, etc.? Okay. First one is, Mr. Hamill, is it possible to really buy a business with little or no money? How about if you have bad credit because of a sizable debt, and how about if you're unemployed?
Okay. First of all, let's take the bad credit. Well, let's say you just filed bankruptcy. If you go in a deal and you have a broker, there's a slight chance that the broker is going to go out and run a check on you, okay, or convince the seller to do this. Now, if you're going directly in and you're just working with a seller on a thing, I have never had one of them ever run a check on myself or anybody else I've been working with. Zero. 50-some years. Okay. So that is not a problem unless you're working with a broker. And again, only part of the time with that. Now, as far as being unemployed, when you go in there, from my standpoint, it's actually none of their business. And you're going to say, well, why shouldn't I tell them and be honest with them? Because they're going to think they're going to have an advantage over you. Why don't you just tell them you also have a club foot or you have bad ears? I said, it's not important to go in there and tell them your life story. Say you lost your job. Well, a lot of people do that all the time. And that's why a lot of people are buying businesses. You don't have to say, the only reason I'm here is I just lost my job. What you want to do is keep it positive. It's just like to tell you, when you go out to get another job, if you're in there and you're telling the agent, say there's an agent representing you to find a job, or maybe the person owning the business, if you go in there and you start talking about the fact that you lost your job and all this, and you're basically whining, even though you don't realize it, you're not going to get the job because you're going to turn off the people you're talking to. You can't go in there and do something like that. You have to go in there with good spirit. You're going to put this deal together. I don't have any problems. You can say, okay, my daughter also fell off her bicycle. Who cares? I mean, what you have to do is, again, as you get to know them later, if you want to talk about your daughter falling off the bicycle, that's fine. But while you're in there in the beginning and you're trying to establish credibility and trying to make them feel good about you, that you can put the deal together and you're a real good person, you keep that to yourself. I mean, why would you bring it up other than you want to bring it up? Also, in all the years I was teaching, we were always running up against other seminars in the United States in real estate that were teaching nothing down. In other words, you can get in on this real estate, and they'd always say to me, you're one of those nothing down persons, Hamill. I said, no, I'm not. I said, you have never heard me say nothing down or ever offer it out. I said, because the chance of you finding a business that you can buy with nothing down is zero. They're going to say, well, how do we buy a business if we don't have money? I said, that's a different thing. What we're saying is nothing down means that you're not going to give the seller any money, right? You're not going to give them anything. In our transactions, what we're doing is we're doing 100% financing or close to it. On something like that, what you're going to find on the average, say a manufacturing company. We recommend a lot of times manufacturing company because they have the most assets available to finance. They have the equipment, they have the accounts receivable, they have the inventory, plus other techniques also that you can get through Michael's program. So there's a lot of different ways to go, especially in manufacturing. And so with that, what's going to happen is we go in, and a lot of times you can get owner financing, okay? All you do is spend enough time. In other words, instead of spending an hour or an hour and a half talking to the seller, we recommend that you spend 4 or 5 hours. And you're going to say, my God, I'll never be able to do that. Yes, you will, because you're going to keep asking the seller questions like, tell me how you got started in this business. You don't ask questions that have yes-no responses. By the time you get to the third hour, the owner's going to know you pretty well. And at that time, you can bring up, would you consider financing? You don't hit them with it in the first hour because they don't know who you are. And even if they told a broker or somebody else that they would provide financing, they really don't want to. So we wait till the third hour, fourth hour, whatever it happens to be. We now have owner financing. We usually try to go after owner financing for, say, 30, 40% of the company, sometimes 50. The problem is once you get above 50, the average person, no matter where you're on the planet, will want outside collateral. They'll want real estate for collateral. They'll want a bank guarantee for collateral. If you stay below 50%, that does not come up. Now, once you get the owner financing in place, you're going to find in the average business with the normal pricing, again, that's the same pricing type we have year in and year out, you're going to find that you'll be able to finance 100% of that company and still have 50% of the cash flow left. Now, our rule has always been 50%. Michael will tell you, working with the investors that we have, our deal with investors, our deal with financing has been 50%. In other words, if you, the buyer, don't have 50% left after you either brought investors in or you financed assets and got owner financing, you don't have 50% left. Again, that could be plus or minus a couple of percent. But if you're off that by a lot, you did something wrong. The business isn't priced right. Arithmetic-wise, this is not rocket science. I can tell you, arithmetic-wise, it doesn't make sense. And if you would come back to me or back to my office, we would talk you out of it every time. And have we? I think so, because you're making a mistake. So when you start to think about bankruptcy, don't have the down payment, blah, 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 these are excuses people make to themselves so they can't succeed in business. When I used to teach all the time, first thing I always do, first morning, I'd say, okay, everybody take out a yellow sheet of paper, whatever color the paper is. I don't care what color it is. It could be green. Take out a sheet of paper. Once you take it out, I want you to write down all the reasons that you've heard of or all the reasons your family told you that nobody can succeed in business or why you can't get in business, whatever the excuse is. You read in the paper about some person that failed, and so you know that's the reason. What I want you to do is write down every one of these things on a sheet of paper. Okay, start now. Okay, so they go through this. When they were done, I said, okay, every one of you, I want you to fold up that piece of paper and put it in your pocket. When you get home, I want to put it in your desk drawer. Or if you have a safe deposit box, put it in your safe deposit box. I don't want you to take it out again until after you close on your business. Once you buy your first business and you've closed, you've taken over, you are now in control. You take out that sheet of paper and read it. And you're going to find that none of these things, zero, none of these things came true. How do I know? We had some thousand people go through our seminar, and I talked to tens of thousands of people since then, and I always tell them this story and set this rule up. You know how many people have come back over all the years? None. Why? It's a fantasy. That's what keeps people. Everybody should be in business. The hell of working for somebody else. And all I'm saying is try this yourself as you're buying a business, and you'll see by the time you get there, none of these things came true. Now, if you'll listen to me and you believe in me, that I can tell you right now as you look into my eyes, all the things that you have, we have to take you to a hypnotist and we're going to have him remove all these thoughts from your mind and then you'll succeed. So as these things come up, close your eyes, bite your tongue, bite your lip and say, it's not going to happen. It's not true. It's something I read that's garbage.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The seminar promoter who I think was around during your time, Gordon Bazaar, and he has some creative financing that seems like it may be a good way to go in today's economic climate. How do sellers and banks react to these creative financing Bazaar techniques?
Well, I've known Gordon for many years. He's a good friend. I don't remember all the techniques, but again, what you're going to find is you're not going to tell them that you're using a creative technique, whether it's real estate or business. What you're doing is you're using it as a technique to buy the business, and you don't talk about it. So when you get in there, the technique you're using is not going to be obvious. It's not going to be something that is going to scare the banker or do anything, because we're not going to describe to them what we're doing. In other words, we're coming in and we're trying to finance something, or we're trying to do something creative on the thing. The average person, including the bankers, are not going to recognize what you're doing. The same thing happens in real estate when people are using creative techniques in real estate. And they have lots of real estate techniques, because I'm in that business also. And all I can tell you is that does not come up. Again, put that on the list of one of the top 50 things that people think are going to happen that don't happen.
Okay. If you don't have much of your own funding to buy a business, where do you find it?
First of all, you're going to find owner financing is one way you're doing it, which represents a lot of it. You're going to be financing assets. It's called a leverage buyout. I mean, there's two ways that we go. Sometimes we have investors, and that's one way to put a deal together. The other way is a thing called a leverage buyout. A leverage buyout means that you're getting owner financing on part of it, and then you're financing assets for the rest of it. You know, equipment, accounts receivable, inventory, those things. All the assets that you have in the company, you're financing. Again, you're not going to over-finance it. We don't want to give up more than 50% of our cash flow. Oh, we want 50% left after we do all of this. And again, I don't care what country you're in, you're going to find that almost everybody in your country that has ever financed anything has done it that way. Whether it's called leverage buyout or not, that's what most of them have been.
Didn't you tell me there was a percentage of like almost all the businesses sold through brokers are all owner financing?
Brokers are going after owner financing. That's the number one thing that they teach brokers in broker school. Or when they work for me, we were teaching our people to get owner financing. Because the problem is, every broker will tell you this, it is very difficult to get financing for businesses. And the average broker is going to tell you, if they don't get owner financing, whether the economy is good or bad, the chance of that transaction going together is not good. Now, do you know what the sales rate in the United States is for brokers? On the average, and again, I don't believe this, is 20%. They sell 20% of their listings. So at 1 in 5, I know, but when somebody comes up with a figure like that, it's always a lie.
You think it's less than that?
Of course it is.
What do you think it is realistically?
I have no idea. It's not very high because of all the stumbling blocks of the things they put up. Because when I was in that business, I said, okay, what I want you to do, the brokers, because I was training them, I visited all 5 offices once a month because we also had marketing sessions in each one of the 5 cities. So I go in there and I tell them that you have to qualify them, you have to do the following, but you have to do it in such a way you're not going to irritate them, and you can't turn down all the people you have coming in. You're going to say, okay, the business is $100,000. Do you have $100,000 cash? That's what the average broker thinks. And you'll say, no, I'm going to borrow half of it. Or the business is priced at $10 million, and I have 4. I'm going to borrow 6. Even on that, they'll hang up on you. And what they do is they kill a lot of deals. And I used to have the same problem years ago with our brokers who were doing the same thing. They would come in nice and clean without all these bad habits, and then I'd have to spend my time hitting them on the head when I'd come in because they weren't going to make any money. They didn't listen.
So you look at this huge market out there. Every year, there must be at least a couple hundred, 200,000, 300,000 businesses that owners are trying to sell or who would like to sell. And probably 96-97% of that, they never, ever get sold. And they just either close down or, I guess the owner would just keep running.
They will close down. And those are the ones not doing well. But there's a lot of them that are doing well. They get to the point where they want to sell.
Yeah, what happens when there's one doing well?
It doesn't sell?
Yeah.
What they do is they take it off the market. What happens if you have a house that doesn't sell?
Yeah, that's true.
Whatever it is, they take it off the market. They don't destroy it or anything. They just take it off the market. But that happens a lot.
Well, there's still got to be businesses that are doing well. If they set it up right and the owner maybe gets sick or something happens, you know, what happens then?
Oh, the owner gets sick?
Yeah. I guess it's just the management.
That's really a problem. But you see, the average owner is going to tell you he has ill health.
Yeah.
And years ago, we used to have a form. We'd have them fill it out in the corner, and it would say, reason for selling. And they would always put ill health in. So when I had the thing reprinted, and I couldn't resist doing this, I put down, reason for selling. And then I put down, ill health, check if other.
That's funny.
Well, the reason I did that is to get them away from that, because they'll talk about retirement, they'll talk about all sorts of things. What happens is the average person does get tired of their business. I don't care how good it is or how good it's been for years, but after 5 years or 10 years or whatever it happens to be, it is very boring and you want out. And I always try to find out why they're selling. I want to make sure there's not some major problem with it. But I usually find it out in the first meeting. Usually that's in the 4th to 5th hour. And when I tell people this, they keep saying, well, why would anybody spend that much time? Because our deal when we go in is to put every deal together. I don't go into a transaction to practice. We're going in there to buy that company.
And they're going to say ill health because they don't want to tell the potential buyer that they're bored with the business. And they're not going to say, hey, it's a boring business, I want out.
It doesn't have to be boring. It's just after you've done the same thing over and over again for a number of years. Or what happens is a lot of times the guy likes the company. And what he should do is hire a manager or bring a manager in to run the company. But he doesn't do that. What he does is continue to work 60, 70 hours a week. And then, again, the solution would be to hire a manager. But the average person doesn't do that.
Right. They don't want to give up control.
Well, when I'm in there and buying a company and I see this, I don't sit down and say, why don't we set it up and we'll get a manager for you? It'll solve the problem. Or why don't you sell it to your son?
No, you're not going to tell him that. You want to buy it. You'll buy it and take care of it.
That's right. Also, you can get bored. Check my career. I've been in business 50-some years, and if you checked it, almost every category of it I have done for 15 years. And I didn't even realize it until somebody, maybe it was you, that asked me to put together a background. And I found out I did this for 15. They always overlapped all the things I did, but I found out 15 years I got bored, just like with the education business. I mean, I did that for 15 years. I did Mexico for 15 years.
Can you buy a company without money down, but just from the cash flow?
Okay, you're going to the second point when you're talking about doing it from the cash flow. There are ways to do it from the cash flow, but from the standpoint of buying a business, what we're doing is we're getting the owner to finance part of it, but he finances 40%, say, okay? If we finance assets for the rest of it, how much does he get back? He gets 60% back. Because every asset that we finance or refinance, that money goes to the seller. So if we, on the average, are getting 30, 40% owner financing, that means that 60, 70% is going to be cash back to the seller. We haven't had any that I've seen with the owner taking nothing down. Now, would they do it maybe if they were about to fail? Maybe so. But on all the ones I've ever worked on all the years I've been doing this, we have not had that problem. So nothing down is something they talk about in real estate. We don't ever talk about that in business. We don't have that.
Here's one related to cash flow. Would you buy a business with no cash flow but you think has future potential?
Okay, whether it has no cash flow or negative cash flow, it could have potential. What I have found, and again, I've done a number of turnarounds. A type A is a turnaround where I come in as a consultant, you put up the money, and I do the turnaround with your money. That's pretty easy. Second type turnaround is what we did on a couple of companies in Mexico, where we have a problem to do a turnaround, and I put the money up. When I'm doing it with your money, I never had a problem, never had a worry. When I was doing it with my money and knew that I had negative cash flow, I wasn't going to make payroll on Friday, as an example, I got very nervous. All I can tell you is based on my experience doing this, both basically as a consultant and as a buyer of companies, I have found that you can actually put together and buy a good business for less money and don't have to go through those hassles. Now, if you're a person that likes to be punished and wants to screw up his life, go after the turnarounds. Go after the ones that don't make any money. There are no businesses out there that are not making money or making very little money that are worth going after. That right next to it, right across the street, there's another business there that you can get for the same price. By the same price, the business that's a turnaround, the one not doing well, is going to cost you X number of dollars. It's going to cost you X number of dollars until the time you break even and you start to make money. The company you're buying across the street is going to cost X number of dollars, but it's already making money. You're going to find that turnaround that you have that you think you're going to put together for a couple $1,000 turns out to cost you as much or more than buying the existing company and not have all the sweat. You know, in the old days, when I teach a class, we put on free lectures. And the first thing I always do when I started off on a free lecture, I say, how many people are here tonight because they'd like to buy real estate? Or how many people would like to buy real estate? Whatever. And almost everybody raised their hand. Well, we want to buy real estate. Okay. How many people here would like to start a business? And I probably have 10, 20% of people raise their hands. Now, in 15 years, third question I'd ask is, how many people here tonight would like to buy an existing company, one making money? You know how many people raised their hands in 15 years? None. So every time I did a free lecture, I had to turn them around in an hour and a half or 2 hours and get them thinking about buying an existing company because nobody at that time believed in it. They didn't believe it could be done. They didn't use it as a technique. When we first started teaching years ago, we had a lot of people from the auto industry. Because back in the days when I first started teaching, everybody thought that if you wanted to expand the company you had, you'd go out and you'd start another one down the street. Nobody was ever thinking about buying an existing one, you know, to add to your company to make it easier. And again, in those days, we had key people from the auto industry, all of them, that were doing that. We had people from every industry coming in, not because they thought I was so bright. It's just that it was a different concept than they had, because they hadn't thought about it. Since then, it's become the number one thing. Everybody wants to buy an existing company. And what you have to do as you're going through this is believe. Again, over the years, I'm sure if we took a percentage of the people that I met for the first time that ever believed anything I was saying, it was probably a very small number. But then they go out and try to experiment with it, and they try it. All of a sudden, they find out, my God, this works. I am not a rocket scientist. I made this work. And again, understanding this rocket scientist thing sometimes confuses people, because they said, oh, this is going to be easy. I said, no, nothing buying a business is easy. It's simple. Simple. There's nothing that we do buying a company that's complicated. If you find something that's complicated, even if it's creative, don't do it. Because there's other techniques around where you don't have to do anything that's complicated. So keep in mind, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be lots of harassment. There's going to be a lot of things going wrong. But it's still going to end up being easy. People that I have all the time come to me and say, you know, after I buy this company, are you going to be around? They asked me about my age. They said, like, are you going to be around long enough to help me on the second business? I said, what are you talking about? They said, how old are you? They know how old I am. They say, are you going to be around? I said, look it. I just want to tell you one thing. Of all the years I've been doing this, again, almost everything that people relate to me is 100%. So when they say to me, will you help me on the second business? I'm going to tell you square, looking you in the eye. Of all the years I've been doing this and all the people I've been working with, I've never had one person, not one, ever come back on the second one. Why? Because they found out as they were going through escrow that, my God, I didn't need Hamill's help. This is very easy. Simple. Excuse me, did I say easy? I just screwed up. I didn't mean to say easy.
Art, I listened to all of your previous conference calls with Michael Senoff. I've been looking at BizBuySell for the past few days. I see a ladies and children's clothing manufacturer here in L.A. Asking price is $9.5 million and cash flow is $3.1 million. It says the owner will carry financing of only $1 million. How can I, with no money and bad personal credit, buy this business?
Okay, first of all, let's go back a step on this. One of the most dangerous businesses to buy is a clothing manufacturing company. I have never helped anybody buy a clothing manufacturing company because of the risk factor. And the risk factor is based on the fact of how tough the people are in this business. I mean, I don't care who you're working with in the clothing business. They're going to be tough to get along with. Most of them are not too honorable in the way they work. Now, can you finance these things 100% or closer? Yes, you can. Why? Because, first of all, the owner's carrying back $1 million. Now, $1 million, if you're not feeling good about the owner of this business or the business, is really not enough, because you're saying, okay, this is going to be a risky business. It's going to be risky from the standpoint of the owner, things he told me or didn't tell me. And so on a $9 million deal, I need at least $4 million. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold back part of it for the first year. Because what's going to happen is they're going to misrepresent. Now, it's a good thing when they start off telling you they're going to carry back financing for $1 million. Because then with the assets, because you'll have accounts receivable, because in the clothing business, almost all of them keep financing the receivables. They either finance them or sell them or whatever. They're also financing their inventory all the time. And the reason for that is because of the cash flow shortages that you normally have in a business like this. The other thing is the competition you have, and that's not only from people that you're going to be competing with, but also from the people that you just bought the company from. All I'm telling you is to beware. Also, it's almost as bad as buying a company where you're working with the auto industry, where they're going to put pressure on you every hour of every day for the rest of your life, which will drive you nuts. In this business, it's just too dangerous. So you're going to find, if you look at the list that I have, I put out, you're going to find out there's two areas that we always tell people we will not get involved in, either as a buyer or to assist somebody. Number one, if it's a clothing manufacturing company of any type, any place in the world, because it applies all over the world. And I have worked with a number of these companies. As an industrial engineer, we had battles with unions in the beginning, with the ladies, whatever it was, workers union, whatever it was, the one that represent the union employees that you have. They're just tough companies. That's about all I can say on it.
Stay away from it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can you still buy a $20 million company with 10% down is the question.
Okay. When somebody asks me, well, they can buy a $20 million company with 10% down, it really doesn't come up in the transaction, because if you get in there and let's say you get the owner to carry back financing for 10%, you're going to say, well, we just failed because we only got 10% financing. Whatever owner financing you can get is fine. Now, if you find a company with heavy assets, like what I'm working on right now back in Massachusetts, it's a manufacturing company. They're in the metal processing business back there. And this price includes the real estate. I'm not going to tell you what it is right now, but all I can tell you is the assets appear before I get there to be about 50% larger than the whole value of the company, which means if this were really true, you know, saying if it was really true, what would happen is I'd have no trouble financing it. But if it starts off and the owner says, I'll finance 10%, they say, hey, that's a great start. Because in the meeting, if he's already saying he'd go 10%, and let's say we get up to the third or fourth hour of negotiating with him, there's a good chance he's going to go up to 30-40%, because he's already talking about 10. The ones that tell you no financing are the ones that are the biggest problems. So what happened is, if it does turn out to be just 10, in a lot of the companies you're going to find, we have enough assets to finance to cover the other 90% of the purchase price.
What about the companies who say absolutely no financing? What's your take on those when you see something like that?
Okay, well, if they tell me there's no financing, what I have to say is I go to their balance sheet to see what kind of assets they have. Again, I'm looking at the key assets plus other techniques. You know, from all the programs that I have in the program that Michael sells, we have a lot of other techniques that have to do with taking your accounts receivable and telling the woman that you have, to say that's in charge of accounts receivable receiving, that you're going to pay a 10% discount or 5% discount since people pay earlier. What happens is that brings in hundreds of thousands of dollars. On the other side, we take the accounts receivable that are paying in 30 days and move them out to 60. And again, mathematically, if that's $1 million and you move it out 30 days, you've just picked up how much? $1 million. So these are only basic techniques that we have. Again, all I'm saying is with normal owner financing, again, even 10%, and also with financing assets like accounts receivable, equipment, and inventory, just take notes. Almost every time you'll be able to finance 100%. Now, the other techniques that we teach, I always tell you, don't use them on the first business because you're not going to have confidence in them. You're going to say, oh, this doesn't work. What happens is buy the business, put the thing together, then after you close and take it over, then have your employees do the following techniques to bring in money or move the payment periods out or whatever it happens to be. Because there's a lot of different ways to do this. Because Michael was talking about, you know, things that are creative. I've been doing these for so many years, I don't consider these to be creative. The other things are also just a normal part of buying a company. And again, if the company makes sense, if the company is well-priced, in other words, market price, whatever that happens to be, you're going to find you can put the transaction together. Do is stay away from the ones that are ridiculously overpriced. Again, in Michael's material that he has, we also have multiples in there. In other words, multiples that we recommend that Michael has put out. And with these multiples of cash flow, it basically tells you which ones are going to work before you even start. That's not very difficult.
All right, great. That's perfect. All right, well, that's the end of this session. And on our next call, we'll cover the section, what is the best type of business to buy and how do you find it? That's the end of our first part of our teleseminar with Art Hamill. I hope it's been helpful, and please stay tuned and check your email for when the second part is available. Thanks for listening.